Next case is 07-1752, State of Ohio versus Ernest Hollingsworth. Ms. Agar.
Thank you. The United States Supreme Court has said that there's no aspect of procedural due process that's more central to our whole concept of the justice system than the right to notice and a chance to be heard. This seems to be this court's day for interpreting rules involving notice and a chance to be heard. Ernest Hollingsworth was a criminal defendant in Hamilton County. He was originally represented by retained counsel. At some point in the proceedings below, he and his family ran out of funds. He was convicted as a result of a plea mid-trial in the case. There was a direct appeal in the matter at which he was represented by counsel, but of course, in post-conviction matters, he was not entitled to court-appointed counsel, and at the time that his post-conviction petition needed to be filed, his family did not have the money to retain counsel, so he filed pro se. At some point later in the proceedings, his family scraped up some money and hired counsel to represent him, and from that point on, he was represented in the post-conviction matter.
Can you help me understand precisely what the Public Defender's Office, as you know, has indicated that there really is no trial transcript here, is there? There was no trial.
There actually was a trial that was started.
Okay. Yeah.
But that trial ended midway before it was ever submitted to a jury by an agreed plea. And therefore, the defendant was not contesting anything that happened with regard to the trial itself. The issues in both his direct appeal and in his post-conviction proceeding all revolve around the pretrial motion to suppress issue. And therefore, the trial itself, what there was of it, was never transcribed because none of it was necessary to illuminate any of the issues on direct appeal.
Because there was not an offer of evidence in what we usually have in a trial. It was all regarding the procedural issues. Is that correct?
That's correct.
That's what the record, that's the transcript
that's
shows.
That's correct. There was no issue on appeal that had anything to do with the testimony that took place at the trial. So when appellant filed his docket statement, the docket statement indicated that he would be ordering only the transcript of the motion to suppress in terms of the actual transcription. Now, obviously, the state would have had the chance if they wished, if they thought there was something in that trial transcript that was necessary to process the appeal, the state could have asked under Appellate Rule 9B to have the remainder of the proceedings transcribed. That did not occur. So the only transcript that was filed was a transcript of the proceedings at the motion to suppress hearing.
Thank you.
May I just follow up a little bit procedurally? Your client filed originally in the Court of Appeals instead of in the Common Pleas Court.
That is correct.
And but for that filing, had that filing been done, it would have been a timely.
It would have been timely no matter how the rule was interpreted.
And we don't get a due process issue then on a notice from the court reporter. Or why shouldn't we say that's a mistake of the filing, of the individual made that filing?
Well, there's no indication that the filing was made at that time with any understanding of when it was due. He was preparing the thing pro se. He put it in the mail when he thought he had it ready to go.
Well, there was a time limit of 180 days.
That's correct. And he was well within at that point in time. He was several months within the time limit at that point in time. But not because he was aware of when the time ran out, just because he filed it as soon as he got it finished.
But he knew that the court reporter would have it prepared on March 20th because he put that in the docketing statement.
Well, see, that's the problem. And when the state refers to appellant knew this and appellant did that in its brief, he's not taking into account the fact that Mr. Hollingsworth did not represent himself on appeal. Mr. Hollingsworth did not prepare the docket statement. There's no indication that Mr. Hollingsworth ever even received a copy of the docket statement.
How would we know if we look at a pleading before a court? I mean, shouldn't we impute that to the defense or to the state as a representative, as representative of the knowledge of that party before the court?
Again, the problem is here we're talking about two different proceedings. We're talking about the direct appeal and the post-conviction proceeding.
I understand.
Mr. Hollingsworth did not prosecute the direct appeal himself. He was represented by counsel, and he had no control over what he did or did not receive from counsel. Even worse, and the state says, well, we should distinguish between transcripts and the docket and the journal entries because the docket and the journal entries are available to everybody at the clerk's office and online, and they're always available, and there's no time problem with that. But the transcript has to be prepared by the court reporter. Again, that ignores the problem of incarcerated pro se litigants. The docket and journal entries are not available to everyone. They are not available to incarcerated pro se litigants who cannot walk down to the clerk's office and view them in the file and who are not allowed to go online and receive those documents off the computer. They can write to the clerk's office and ask for these things to be supplied, or they can write to previous counsel and ask counsel to send them, but they're pretty much at the mercy of one of those individuals reading their letter and agreeing to do that. Some do, some don't. And in terms of the docket statement, this is the document that counsel preparing the appeal prepares basically for the court's information. There's really not any requirement or reason why counsel would send that to the defendant.
What is the rule that you would have us write?
I don't see any need for the court to write a rule. We have a rule. The rule says 180 days from the filing of the transcript of proceedings, or of the trial transcript. I would simply have the court, there is no definition anywhere in the rules or the statutes for that term trial transcript. I would simply have the court read trial transcript to mean the transcript of all the proceedings, not only the court reporter's transcript of what was said in court, but the transcript prepared by the clerk of the docket and journal entries.
So you would have us read trial transcript more expansively to say the record in the court below?
Basically to say the record on appeal, which we do have a definition for and is defined in the appellate rules. The statute used a term that has no legal definition and is not defined anywhere, either in the statutes or the rules.
The court did not send out, just to make sure I have the sequence right, did the court send out a notice of the filing of the trial transcript?
Of the transcript prepared by the court reporter when the court reporter filed it? No, and it never does.
But it did send out a notice when the rest of the record was filed.
That's correct. The clerk sends out a postcard when it files, when the entire record has been completed. And that postcard would go out. It doesn't matter whether the clerk files its documents first or the court reporter files her transcript first. When the last part of the record is filed, the clerk sends out the postcard saying the whole record is now filed.
You're maintaining that's when the clock should run.
And that's when the clock should run. That's when the appellant has clear notice from the court that the transcript has been filed.
Did your client receive that notification from the court reporter or from the court?
There was, in fact, and a copy of it is attached in the back of my brief. There was, in fact, a postcard sent out stating that the entire record, including transcript of proceedings, has been filed, and that was in the April date.
To your client?
I believe it was sent to counsel who was handling the appeal. And that's where it would normally go, is the counsel who was counsel of record for the appeal.
And was it counsel who handled the appeal that filed the docket, the Rule 3G docketing statement?
That would be the counsel who would have filed the docket statement.
Thank you.
But again, the docket statement doesn't give a date when the record will be filed. The docket statement gives a certification by the court reporter that I estimate that I will be able to have the transcript prepared and ready to file by such and such a date.
That's what it said. The transcript will be prepared and ready for filing on March 3rd, 05.
Yeah, and that's not the date the transcript was filed. The transcript was actually filed 17 days prior to that. So the docket statement gives no notice at all of when even the transcript of proceedings is filed.
Thank you.
Counsel, isn't your remedy really with the legislature to clarify the statute? rather than asking us to disregard the, what is apparently clear language. The transcript, it doesn't say transcript, it says trial transcript, so it obviously has something to do with the proceedings, not the whole record of the case. Wouldn't that be a better remedy than asking this court to sort of rewrite this statute?
Again, if there was a definition of trial transcript that defined trial transcript the way counsel wants it, for the state wants it defined, then yes, I'd be asking you to rewrite the statute. But there is no definition. Nor does a plain reading of the statute show that that kind of definition would make any sense at all, because the statute provides basically for two starting times, either when the transcript is filed or when the time for filing the notice of appeal runs out. It makes no provision at all if we're reading transcript to mean only a transcript of verbatim what was said during a trial of the matter. If that's how we're going to interpret it, and that's what counsel for the state is saying, it makes no provision at all for when the time starts to run in an appeal where there is no trial transcript.
But that isn't the case before us, where there is no trial transcript. There is a transcript of some proceedings in court.
And that's
if,
correct.
If we would interpret trial to mean any proceedings in court that's recorded that needs to be a, or is made a part of the record.
That's correct.
And
but
that,
where
that
the
wouldn't apply to your case, because there is one.
But where the statute's not clear as to what that term trial transcript means. And this statute isn't clear because it doesn't provide us a definition. The court can look at the rest of the statute to see for a common sense reading of what was intended by that term. And if that term was intended only to mean a verbatim recording of the proceedings at trial of the matter, there's a whole class of defendants who have no notice at all when their time starts to run for filing post-conviction. I know the state of Ohio says they can't conceive of an appeal without a trial transcript. Well, you got one in front of you right now, because a hearing on a motion to suppress is not a trial. And there is no trial transcript in this case. There was no trial transcript by the definition supplied by the state ever filed in this case because it wasn't necessary for the direct appeal. Furthermore, there are cases, and I've been involved in a few in front of this court, where, for example, the trial judge declares a criminal statute unconstitutional and dismisses the charge on the basis of that declaration, due to a stipulated set of facts without an evidentiary hearing based on legal memoranda. There would be no trial transcript in that case. When does the statute start to run in that case? When can the defendant file his post-conviction act? If we read this trial transcript to mean only what the court reporter took down, then there's no provision for that. It's not a sensible reading of the term. You know, maybe the term is a little inartful, but statutory interpretation is part of this court's job.
But we don't really have to reach that question in this case, do we? And therefore shouldn't reach it because we're talking about one in which there is a transcript filed of a proceeding in a court. And so at the most we could do would be to interpret trial transcript to mean any transcribed proceeding of the court that's filed, particularly if there's a hearing or a trial-like procedure.
You can interpret it to mean transcript of proceeding before the court, but that's going to include the journal and the docket and the journal entries of the court, because that's part of the proceedings before the court, just like a hearing on a motion to suppress is. Neither one of them are a trial, and the case law is very clear that the word trial does not encompass either one of those things, but they're both the proceedings before the court. And that's what I'm asking this court to do, interpret it to mean the transcript of the proceedings before the court, but all the proceedings. Not just a partial transcript that could have been modified or added to by appellee at their discretion, or that might not even have been filed at all if it wasn't necessary to reflect the error on appeal. And not only does that comport with a sensible reading of the statute, but it comports with due process. Because if we read this statute the way counsel for the state wants you to read it, it does not provide notice and a chance to be heard, especially to indigent and incarcerated defendants who don't have access to the docket. And in fact, in some counties, don't even have access to a copy of the transcript, because many courts have been denying a separate copy of the transcript to defendants. And they are solely at the mercy of whether counsel will hit the Xerox machine and make a copy for them, which may or may not show the timestamp filing date. In this case, the copy of the transcript that Mr. Hollingsworth had was one that his counsel had prepared after the motion to suppress was heard to use during the course of the trial, and had never been filed and didn't have a file stamp on it.
Ms. Agar, it looks as though the notice that the transcript, at least on the 29th of November, we have the copy, 2006, where there's a reference to Rule 11B of the Appellate Rules of Procedure. Is that where the postcard gets sent to the defendant?
Yes.
So you're saying that really should be the date by which we then calculate the 180 days.
Sure, and that's the date when the entire record is accessible, is available to counsel for either side, to the appellant himself if he can manage to get it from the clerk's office, and to the trial judge who will ultimately have to address the issues in the post-conviction motion. Again, a common sense reading would say then the date that we have all the information is the sensible date to start the running of the statute. And it's sensible to interpret the statute in that fashion.
So the word trial transcript, in your view, you've used several different terms. You've said entire record, you've said record of the proceedings, you've said all of the, what is the definition that you would propose for that term trial transcript?
I would say the record of proceedings, since we do have a clear definition for that. And that is the record that appellant receives notice of.
Thank you, Ms. Agar. Mr. Heenan.
Ms. Agar keeps going back to what does a trial transcript mean in many of her arguments. And one of the things she has done is taken the language I quoted from Blacks and has said that trial transcript in that case would only be proceeding where we would be determining the defendant's guilt, where we would either have a jury that had been impaneled or the judge listening to the facts and determining if the defendant was guilty of the crime. That limited definition of what a trial is not in any way what was intended by the definition in Black's. And if you look at the definition of a trial in Black's dictionary, it explains that it includes determining issues of law and fact, not just guilt or innocence. As far as there not possibly being a transcript that could be filed, where I'd said I can't fathom an instance where there would be a post-conviction petition, where there wouldn't be some type of transcribable material. A post-conviction petition, by its very name, implies that there's been a conviction. A conviction is a finding of guilt plus a sentence. Those are things that are going to take place, and they're going to be taken down by a court reporter. Those are going to be recorded. So in any case where there's going to be a post-conviction petition, there will have been some transcribed material. Some material.
Would that be a plea as well?
Yes, a plea requires a criminal Rule 11 hearing.
A plea is not a trial, is it?
No.
So even your own definition of trial transcript involves something that is not actually a trial.
It would be a hearing. And I, if you were to limit the word trial to just meaning a time when witnesses were called and arguments were made and then a final finding was made, then yes, that would be the only time a trial would occur. However, there are many times where things are going to be transcribed in a trial court that are going to be hearings on motions, such as this, where it was a motion to suppress.
What is wrong with saying that the trial transcript, since you already conceded it has different definitions, even in your own version, includes everything that's filed, it's completed, then the notice is sent? What is wrong with a simple, clear, bright line interpretation like that?
If the legislature wanted to use it, there would have been nothing wrong with that. However, there was the defined record on appeal, which includes a transcript. That the term record on appeal is defined. If the legislature wanted to say that it needed to include all of the papers of the case, not just any materials that were transcribed, they could have used the term record on appeal, but they chose instead to use trial transcript.
Then they could also use the term trial and hearing transcripts. So therefore, none of the cases that are hearings, that are pleas, are subject to that rule. So when does the statute start on them?
I think at that point you're giving much too limited of a definition of the word trial. The trial transcript refers to transcripts of what happens in the trial court. And going back to my definition, if you look at the definition of trial on Black's, it includes those types of hearings. It's not limited to just a jury trial or a bench trial.
So if you had a trial, you had a jury verdict, you had jury instructions, you had the verdict read in open court, and all that was transcribed, that would all be trial transcript, but the entry of judgment would not be.
The entry of judgment would be part of the docket and journal entries. That would not be part of the trial transcript. The trial transcript would be those matters that were taken down by the court reporter and then later typed up.
And how does the pro se defendant get notice of a trial transcript being filed?
The same way the counsel would. If, in this case, his counsel received notice of these things.
Pro se, I'm talking pro se, not counsel. How would he get notice?
A pro se appellant who would have ordered these transcripts would have received a copy when he asked for them. A copy would have been sent to the state, a copy would be sent to the appellant. So he would have received a copy that way.
Would he know when the transcript was filed? That's the key, that's the critical point, isn't it, under the statute? Due process issue, I guess that's the question. Somebody's in prison and they have no idea when the transcript actually gets filed in the court. Is that true or is that not true?
I don't know the answer to that. I don't know what the prisoners do or do not get.
Doesn't Appellate Rule 11B say upon receipt of the record, the clerk shall file the record and shall immediately give notice to all parties of the date on which the record was filed? And then that section goes on to talk about post-conviction relief as well. So that seems to apply to this case, does it not?
11B directs the clerk when the record on appeal has been received, which may or may not include a transcript. When the complete record on appeal has been received, they are to send that notice out because that triggers when the briefs are due in the matter. The discussion in that rule about post-conviction petition just recognizes the fact that a trial court has concurrent jurisdiction with an appellate court to continue to rule on that post-conviction petition while appeal is going on, whereas many other instances they would not. That once the appeal had been filed, they would have lost jurisdiction over that matter. Post-conviction petitions are unique in that the trial court gets to maintain the jurisdiction, and they need to have access to those materials as well. And in Hamilton County, that's not very difficult because the Court of Appeals is right across the street from the courthouse. However, in other counties where I'm not sure which circuits or which counties, say the second district covers, they're not going to be right next door to each other. They're covering a number of counties that are going to be far away from each other. So the clerk needs to make sure that the trial court is able to access that record so that it can promptly rule on that post-conviction petition. That's what that rule recognizes, and that's what the purpose of that rule is.
Mr. Heenan, in this case, what significance should we give to the fact that Mr. Hollingsworth filed a pro se petition for post-conviction relief in the appellate court within the time limit?
The only significance to that is that Mr. Hollingsworth made a mistake. He did not follow the rules. The rules don't say to file the petition with the appellate court. They specifically say to file it with the sentencing court. He did not follow those rules.
Well, after the court dismissed it, he refiled it, and then that's what brings us to this issue and the appellate review of his untimely filing.
Yes.
Had he filed it in the common pleas court in a timely fashion, we wouldn't have this issue.
No, we would not.
So, was the original filing in the appellate court a complete filing?
What do you mean by complete filing?
Was there some defect with it, or was it the same document that was simply refiled in the common pleas court at a later point?
I'll be honest with you, I don't remember if any changes were made.
Okay.
To the best of my recollection, no, there were not. If my recollection is correct, I handled the matter in its entirety, and I believe I actually had started writing my response to the petition based off of the Court of Appeals filing, not off of what was refiled in the trial court.
So you don't know how a pro se defendant gets any notice of when a trial transcript, under whether it's your definition of a hearing or an actual trial, you don't know how they get notice.
I don't know how, to be completely honest with you, I don't know how inmates get notice of anything that occurs.
There's nothing sent out from the court when that's filed to any parties.
No. However, take a case where the defendant does not appeal. They have 180 days from the expiration of when they had to file their appeal. They're not given any kind of special notice about when that time for appeal ends. They're not given anything saying you have 180 days from this date. You know, they have some responsibility to figure out some of those dates on their own. So I have those same responsibilities. If a motion is filed, I don't receive a notice that I have 10 days to file my response to it. I just have to look at the motion. If I don't know what the date is, I need to find out. You know, there's some responsibility that comes with these types of pleadings.
But how do you exercise that responsibility if you're incarcerated and don't have access to the docket?
That's something I don't have a good answer for, because I don't know what access they do or do not have. I know that I get many filings from inmates that are filed pro se that have numerous things that they have from the internet attached to them. I don't know if every prison has access to the internet. I don't know if everyone in the prison has access to a phone to call the clerk. These are questions that I don't know, and the record in this case doesn't give me answers to.
Well, if there is a due process argument to be made here, I haven't heard it, but if there is one, a way to resolve that issue would be to adopt the appellant's definition of trial transcript, even though technically it doesn't quite fit what our common knowledge would be of a trial transcript, but yours doesn't fit it either. So if there's an issue of somebody not knowing what their rights are, people in prison in particular, not having access to the court's docket and record, wouldn't that be a way to resolve the issue, at least until the General Assembly can look at this issue?
That still leaves open the question, what about when the defendant does not file an appeal? How will they get noticed then? If you were to adopt that rule,
when
how
a defendant does not file a notice of appeal in a post-conviction?
If the defendant does not appeal, then the time frame is not 30 or 180 days from when the trial transcript is filed with the Court of Appeals. Then it's 180 days from when the time to file his appeal has expired. If you were to create that kind of rule, it creates the problem of then, you know, some defendants will get notice if they file an appeal, but they won't get notice if they don't.
But isn't that where Appellate Rule 11B kicks in? I mean, that's the confusion that I'm having here.
The only purpose for Appellate Rule 11B is to set the dates for when the appellant's brief is due and subsequently when the appellee's brief is due. And in the cases where it's not an accelerated calendar, when the reply brief would be due.
Why can't you read it that it's 180 days from trial unless you appeal, in which case it's when the whatever we define trial transcript is filed?
Well, actually, it would be 180 days from the time to appeal is expired. The only concern I would have with that, again, is that you would then get in a situation where there would be some defendants who would be able to say that the person who's filing their appeal is getting some special notice that I'm not. They're getting things easier than I am. They're not getting that extra.
The rule's automatic. You have 180 days unless you file an appeal. That's pretty clear for a defendant to figure out.
Would this court have authority to clarify this issue and to supplement the statute and require the clerk or the court reporter to provide notice when a trial court transcript is filed?
Sure, the appellate rules could be modified to do that. And that would be a potential solution to this problem. It again still leaves open the problem of those who don't file a notice of appeal.
They would more likely have access to the sentencing's entry, so the judgment entry, and be able to then calculate the time on their own. The problem with this is there's no trigger date that they're necessarily going to have notice of. It's kind of out there somewhere. Maybe they can, maybe they can't. We're not quite sure because we don't know exactly who has access to what. So there would be a distinction of some sort, would there not?
I can see your point there. Yes, I can. I still believe that the proper way to rule in this case is to rule that the 180 days flows from when the trial transcript is filed. That being said, if this court feels otherwise, it's obviously not a rule that the state could not live with. I mean, we'd be okay with that if that's what this court feels is proper. We believe that the proper rule is that it's 180 days from the trial transcript. If you disagree, that doesn't create any huge problems for the state. However, that being said, the reply brief, or, and sorry, the amicus brief in this matter does create an issue that could create a huge problem. And that is where they're suggesting that the 180 days should not run from when the trial transcript is filed, as it was in this case, or when the 11B notice has gone out, as it did in this case. They're arguing in there that it should be the complete transcript of everything that occurred below. That what happened in Mr. Hollingsworth's case, where he only ordered the motion to suppress hearings transcripts, that since there was other stuff that happened afterwards that had not been ordered, that the 180 days shouldn't start until all that other stuff was done, until there's a complete record of everything that was said and done below. That invites great problems, because that invites the possibility for a defendant to do what Mr. Hollingsworth has done in this case, and that's to only order a partial transcript. And there would be no reason in a case like this for the state to order other transcripts. It was an appeal and a motion to suppress. There's no reason for us to need the other stuff that happened after that motion to suppress occurred. But to say that the rest of those transcripts were necessary to trigger that 180 days just invites the possibility for defendants to artificially enlarge that time for filing their post-conviction petitions almost ad infinitum. That would be a problem if this court were to rule the way amicus would have you rule. That would be problematic. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Heenan. Zagar, you've used your time, but you would take 30 seconds. Wave 30 seconds.
Oh.
Okay, thank you. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion. Marshal, please adjourn court.
All right. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. Social Justice of the Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio.
Thank you.